Today's Takeaway podcast is an extended version of what we normally give you on this podcast version of the Takeaway. It's a full version of our radio program plus some extras. We hope you enjoy it. This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry, and thanks so much for listening on this Memorial Day, where we're taking time and reflecting on history this hour, reminding us of just how many wars America has to memorialize. There's the Revolutionary War, the Whiskey Rebellion, the War against Libya, the War of 1812, the French and Indian Wars, the Civil War, the Spanish-American War, World War I, World War II, Korea, Vietnam, Grenada, the invasion of Panama, Gulf War I, Afghanistan, and the invasion and occupation of Iraq. And that's probably not even a complete list, but it is impressive. And it makes the point that American history is largely shaped by war, whatever we may think of ourselves. Kenneth Davis is the author of The Hidden History of America at War, Untold Tales from Yorktown to Fallujah. He says in each war is a parable about what America was struggling with at the time, battles we lost, some we won, and some we are still fighting.
Most of our wars have fallen into that black hole that most of us think of as American history, but we are a nation shaped by war, after all. And what I tried to do in The Hidden History of America at War was look at six emblematic battles over the course of more than 200 years that really talk about who fights our wars, why we go to war, and whether it's ever a good idea.
Yorktown, of course, famous in the Revolutionary War. How does it relate to Balangiga in the Philippines?
Well, each of the stories tells a different story, but there are threads that run through them, of course. And Yorktown 1781 is a perfect example of what I call the stories the school books leave out. It is a story about how Washington won this battle. We see him on his charger afterwards accepting the surrender. But most people don't know how it really happened, and if it weren't for the French, it wouldn't have happened. They also don't know about the involvement of a great many African-American soldiers who Washington did not want to recruit at the beginning of the war, and he had to change his mind, largely through the efforts of three men at Yorktown, Alexander Hamilton, the Marquis de Lafayette, and John Lawrence, a really interesting character, a forgotten founder, I call him, a hero of the Revolution who, unfortunately, this is not a big spoiler alert, but he dies. Well, it's 200 years ago. They all died.
Yeah, right.
But
big surprise.
The real hidden history here is the story of what happens after the battle is over. Washington writes into the surrender document that all of the property held by the British shall be returned to its rightful owners. And by property, everyone understood what he meant. There were about 5,000 African Americans in Yorktown with the British. It was called the greatest slave escape in American history. They were trying to get their freedom. They included 17 people from Washington's own plantation, as well as about 20 from Jefferson's plantations. And this is part of the story that school books leave out, but it's an important one because it really talks about this role of slavery and race from the very beginnings of the country, and obviously we're dealing with it today.
The idea that the United States fought a battle in the Philippines and that the Philippines was once a part of the United States on some level is almost completely unknown by Americans.
It is. This is truly one of our forgotten wars. First of all, most people think about wars and you say how many we've had. We've only had five declared wars, 11 if you count all the separate declarations during the Second World War. And the war against Spain, the war that really made America a global empire, has really receded into that long list of dates and battles we're supposed to learn in high school, and we don't. It's an important story because it's really about America stepping up on the global stage for the first time in history, becoming an empire in many respects, and it was controversial at the time. And what's most fascinating to me, I suppose, about the whole chapter is the role of torture that it would play. Because as I was writing this, of course, we're reading about waterboarding. This was something called the water cure, an ancient Spanish technique that was used during the Inquisition in which copious amounts of water was poured down the throats of a victim as a form of torture. And this wasn't just a quiet little thing. This raised to the level of a Senate investigation that threatened a very young President Theodore Roosevelt, who had just succeeded to the office after the death of McKinley. So it was an extraordinary to go back and look at this debate over torture in a forgotten war more than 100 years ago.
It's also clear that the U.S. had no idea how to deal with the Philippines, an echo or a precursor of what would happen in Afghanistan and certainly Iraq.
And Vietnam, young Americans being sent off to a far away place in Asia that they'd never heard of to fight in conditions they'd never experienced before against an enemy that was a guerrilla enemy at first. Later on, it morphs into a larger war and a longer war against Islamic people, the Moros, they were called. You know, it's not just a matter of telling all the terrible things that we did, but this is part of our DNA as a nation. This is part of our heritage. Every one of these stories that we can look at and shake our heads over the stupidity and the thoughtlessness at different points, we also have to look and admire at the courage, the sacrifice, the honor, and the duty of the Americans who went over there. And so that's part of this story as well. And they get, as in all wars, pretty shoddy treatment.
Growing up as a Cold War journalist, really, that's the period that I came of age. During an enormous period of peacetime, really, I mean, comparatively speaking, Vietnam was over. It would be a long time before the Gulf War. And yet you would talk to people from Eastern Europe with any kind of Eastern Europe European heritage, and they would scream about Potsdam. They would scream about how the United States gave away Europe at Potsdam. And this is the story you tell in your chapter on Berlin, 1945.
That's right. And the fall of Berlin was certainly one of the great set pieces in World War II. Most Americans never learned about it. Certainly I did not, because the Soviet Red Army
right.
did it. And for
exactly.
50 years, we didn't talk about what the Russians did in World War II. It's a savage, horrible story of what happens to Berlin. Hitler is there in his bunker. He marries Eva Braun on the 28th. He commits suicide on the 29th. And by May 1st, the Soviet tanks are in Berlin and the city is crushed. But this also sets the stage then for a divided Berlin, a divided Germany, and 50 years of Cold War conflict. And that's the, you know, there's the little story, the smaller story of what happened in Berlin in April and May of 1945, and then the bigger story of what leads from there. And certainly Potsdam is part of that, where Truman and Eisenhower and Churchill meet with Stalin, and they're really figuring out this whole mess that a crushed Europe, a crushed Germany is going to mean.
And democratic institutions don't just take root in wartime, and that brings us to your portrait of Hue in South Vietnam in 1968, and then, of course, Fallujah, the most recent battle.
Right, and Hue had been spared most of the violence in 20 years of fighting in Vietnam. It had been set aside as a special city. During Tet in 1968, that changed. It was the scene of the longest and perhaps bloodiest single battle in Vietnam history. And really becomes famous, and I think one of the reasons I focused on it is because it became such a magnet for reporters. And I write about how this war really became, the reporters became as much of the story as the soldiers did.
To say that we are mired in stalemate seems the only realistic, if unsatisfactory, conclusion.
When Cronkite goes to Hue and then comes back and issues that famous report in February of 1968 about a quagmire in Vietnam. And Lyndon Johnson says, "If I've lost Cronkite, I've lost America," words to that effect. The country was already moving away from supporting the war before Cronkite did that, but this certainly accelerated the resistance to the war and, of course, changed the scene in America completely with Lyndon Johnson's withdrawal from the race. The other part of this story that was unknown to me before this was the reports of a tremendous civilian massacre in Hue. Supposedly, the North had done it in conjunction with elements of the South Vietnamese Viet Cong. There's some controversy about that as well, but this was an unreported atrocity in Hue in 1968.
in Fallujah, you really have the American war that's not necessarily an American war.
Well, there are so many aspects of Fallujah that fascinated me, but I had to start with that image that we all remember of two bodies dangling from that rusted bridge over the Euphrates River, and the fact that many Americans did not realize they weren't soldiers. They were private security contractors. This was the dawn of the era of the privatized army. They worked for Blackwater specifically, since been sold and renamed several times. There were more private security contractors in Iraq at some points than there were armed military American personnel, a complete change of how we think about who fights our wars. And that's really one of the themes that's running through the book. Who fights our wars? Why we go to war? But one thing never changes, that the men, the Marines, who go into Fallujah in May of 2004 go in with fixed bayonets. No different than the men who went into Yorktown in 1781 with what Washington called cold steel.
But one real difference between what happened at Yorktown and what happened at Fallujah is that America as a nation was completely involved in what happened at Yorktown. The nation was completely involved in the Civil War in 1864 that you describe. By the time we get to 2004... in Fallujah, Iraq, America may be paying attention on television, but the people who fight America's wars are a tiny minority of the country.
You know, we talk a lot about the 1% in this country in terms of the wealthy and the not wealthy. There's another 1%. That's the 1% of American families who have somebody in uniform. Because we went to an all-volunteer army during Vietnam, very few Americans have anything to do with the military. The fact that we now do it with remote control from an air-conditioned box in Tampa Bay controlling drones on the other side of the world, cyber warfare, is changing a lot of what we think of as war. And yes, we are, most of us, completely divorced from it. We have the obligatory, thank a serviceman in the airport or the flyovers at the Super Bowl. But most of us really don't have any connection to this. And that makes it, I think, dangerously easy sometimes to say, well, let's bomb them and let's bomb them without going into any specific suggestions from anybody. And I think that's the real reason that we need to know this stuff. We need to understand that these decisions have extraordinary consequences, not only for the men and women who are fighting, but obviously for the civilians who are trapped between warring armies.
Kenneth Davis is the author of the Don't Know Much About series. His new book is The Hidden History of America at War, Untold Tales from Yorktown to Fallujah. Thanks so much, Ken.
It's always a pleasure to be with you, John. Thanks.
Great. Coming up, a look at the consequences of the war on terror on our privacy and why consumer data has become particularly vulnerable. That's next. Stay with us.
The Takeaway is supported by Lumosity.com, brain training designed by neuroscientists that has been used by 60 million people worldwide. With personalized training programs to challenge memory, attention, and problem solving. Learn more at Lumosity.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI Public Radio International in collaboration with The New York Times and WGBH Boston Public Radio.
Someday there may be wars fought over data. Who gets it? Who can use it? How much of it is available to collect on everyone? Does the NSA need its own army to defend its practices? It probably already has one. But it's not just the NSA. The data trail is unavoidable today. Every time you make an online purchase, swipe your credit card, log onto a website, you leave behind a trail that plays itself out in ways that may not be obvious to you but are tantalizingly attractive to marketing companies, financial companies, and law enforcement. Can buying a pair of hiking boots with your debit card affect how much you pay for health care? According to Pam Dixon, founder and executive director of the World Privacy Forum, it can. Big data is the name for the aggregation and synchronization of all the data trails that we generate. Data brokers, Dixon says, are already hard at work anticipating our every move in a fast-changing environment where the regulators don't have a chance.
In the past, privacy laws have sought to protect information from flowing around about us. There's that very famous Supreme Court dissent that says, you know, privacy is essentially the right to be let alone. But now, every time we use our debit and our credit cards, whenever we live our lives, we're leaving behind a trail of digital breadcrumbs that typically and frequently is amassed to either market to us or to do predictive analytics about our behavior to see what kind of people we may be now or in the future. And one of the things that we've really come to through our research, especially our research in the past 3 years on data brokers, is that we're not going to be able to stop all of the information from flowing. So where does that leave us? I mean, we cannot live in a tinfoil hat city. We just can't. So the other option is to create a new approach to privacy. So that's where we are right now. And basically, the way I like to sum it up is we need the tools and the skills and the rights to be able to shape our digital exhaust.
Is this more sophisticated or fundamentally different than the find out your credit score and get rid of all the false stuff on there?
Finding out your credit score is based on a law that was passed way back in 1974. It's called the Fair Credit Reporting Act. It's a really great privacy law, and it's a really good foundation for what needs to happen today. The only problem that we have is it's kind of like, you know, watching a stone being thrown into a lake. The stone and the water directly over it is like the Fair Credit Reporting Act, and the lake is the rest of the data universe that we find ourselves in now. It's just that the law is so narrow, it doesn't cover all the uses. The old laws need to stay on the books, but we need additional laws that protect how the information is used on the back end. I think that the more we look at this in our organization, the more we've come to understand something, and that is that there's not going to be a one silver bullet solution to the privacy issues that we're all facing today. But a very systemic way that our privacy is being challenged right now is one that's more difficult to get at. And this is something we talked about. Actually, we researched for 3 years for our Scoring of America report. And it's the way that all of the small purchases and activities that we do that are digitally recorded add up to create a meaningful profile about us. Let's see, we're a person who buys hiking goods, or we're a person who smokes or doesn't smoke, that sort of thing. It's a network of information, including educational choices and whatnot, that tends to combine to create predictive profiles of us.
Who are data brokers? I mean, could I like knock on their door and, you know, find
them? Yes, you could. Yeah, certainly the largest data broker in this country is a company by the name of Axiom. And they store a lot of public records data, but they also store a lot of behavioral data that's based off of our purchases and other activities. And actually, everyone can take a look at the kind of information that data brokers have on us by looking at the Axiom website that's called About the Data Portal. And it will tell you what your income is, how many kids you have, the VIN number of your vehicle. It will outline how many dollars you spend online and offline, and a lot of other things about you. So most people don't know that this exists, and it's really worth knowing it exists because this kind of information can be used, for example, to determine a lot of educational decisions, and it can also be used to help determine what you pay for healthcare.
And this is the Axiom portal?
Yes, it's called About the Data. And actually, one of the impediments is that we don't have a legal right to demand to see these reports and scores and information the way we do with our credit report. And that's what we want to see. If there is one thing that we need in this country, it's we need the right to be able to see what data brokers have on us and to correct it. It's very important.
I mean, what's the strategy for protecting yourselves? Because I think we think of privacy as old people as a kind of an on-off thing, lights on, lights off. Mm-hmm. And what you're talking about is much more of being in control of different categories of data.
What happens is that those bits of information can really shape how we are viewed by, for example, healthcare companies, you know, employers, educators. And our strategy is to say, okay, look, you need to look at what you're doing and what you're buying and what information is floating out there about you as much as is possible, and then work to construct a profile that doesn't cause you harm, and also work to understand where that profile is going to intersect with important opportunities in your life. So a very good example of this is there was a health plan that asked a well-known and national data analytics provider to conduct a test to see what of the, I think it was about 1,200 to 1,500 factors or things about people would predict how sick they were or how much they should be charged for healthcare costs. And one of the things that they found, and one of the final factors that they used to determine this, was that what people bought online was enormously predictive of how healthy they were. And this even included if they had purchased hiking goods. So one of the ways to do this is if you are engaging in an activity that is harmful to your health, like smoking, you need to figure out a way to either mask your purchase or to pay cash in that instance. But if you are doing something that society would broadly view as fabulous, go ahead and use your credit and your debit cards. But we do need to consider the impact of what we're doing on our long-term profile, because there are people who are creating one without us really ever knowing about it.
Pam Dixon is founder and executive director of the World Privacy Forum. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
The Takeaway is supported by Squarespace, providing users with tools to create websites for small business or their own personal brand. More information at squarespace.com/takeaway.
A mysterious expedition to an airless moon thousands of years from now. Amidst the desolation, signs of something. 5 pieces of fabric with stripes and little star shapes. 12 pairs of something a creature might wear as part of a spacesuit, I guess. 96 bags of, some kind of biological waste. And here's an image of what these creatures looked like. Ah, they wear those spacesuit things on their feet. These are among the items left behind by the U.S. space program on the moon. The photo, by the way, is of Apollo 16 astronaut Charles Duke. And Jerry Lininger, former NASA astronaut, says human space garbage is very much a part of the whole story of exploration.
I think the, for example, going to Mars is very tough, but the toughest part is getting back from Mars.
Yeah.
It costs, you know, very costly to take up weight, and it's very costly to, you know, pull the debris off of the moon and try to launch it back to Earth. On the other hand, I'll tell you, when I saw photos of some of the reconnaissance spacecraft flying around the moon, and you see the actual footprints, the path that the, for example, Sea of Tranquility, where the Apollo 11 astronauts walked. You see the lander. You see, you know, some of the different marks they made on the moon. You know, it's pretty impressive. And to me, that's sort of an archaeological site and a point of pride that, we were there. You know, mankind was there, left our mark.
A little bit like a, you know, one-year-old's pride in having all that birthday cake on their face.
A little bit, yeah, a little bit. You know, though, on the moon, of course, there's not much, there is no atmosphere, and so there's no wind, no rain, and it just sort of, it'll be there forever. And people are thinking, for example, that Apollo 11 Tranquility Base site, they're trying to preserve that. And of course, the footprints are there, you know, as you mentioned, the trash is there. But there's also, you know, experimental packages that were left behind. And two interesting things, we left some big reflective panels up there. And through those panels, we shoot lasers from the Earth. We're able to get the distance to the moon, for example, very precisely, and also the sort of the perimeter diameter of the moon. And we also left some seismic sensing devices. And when some of these other unmanned aircrafts crash into the moon, we're able to pick up those vibrations. And through that, we're able to pick up the density of the moon. And from that, those two sets of information, for example, you know, we know now the moon's about a quarter of the size of the Earth. And yet you only have about, when you're up there, you feel 1/6 the gravity of Earth. And that's because the moon is less dense. So to some degree, it's debris. To the other degree, you're advancing science, and some of those science packages are left behind.
It occurs to me in thinking about you talking about how we can see all that garbage on the moon. Our best evidence of other life in the universe may be observing some giant garbage pile someday.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, in the presence of mankind is there, and that's where, again, I sort of have some pride that, hey, we've been there. You know, I guess I sort of liken it to the, if you think of the explorers of old and they're on the oceans and you have these shipwrecks. You know, I've done many scuba diving on wrecks, and it's, you know, kind of this really incredible feeling when you say, man, these guys in 1800 were shipping logs, in my case, down Lake Michigan to Chicago. And I'm looking at history here, as you mentioned, an archaeological site almost. And so some of that, you know, the stuff on the moon, for example, it's not like it's, you know, wall-to-wall garbage by any means. Probably the bigger problem is space debris, because that stuff, you know, matter in motion stays in motion, and we still have that orbiting our Earth. And, you know, we've got, 20,000 or so hunks of pretty good-sized stuff orbiting the Earth right now.
Jerry, thanks for joining us.
Hey, it's good talking to you, John. Thank you.
Jerry Lininger is a former NASA astronaut. He was the sole American aboard the Russian space station Mir, which survived the worst fire in space exploration history. He's also the author of Off the Planet. Where does improvised music come from? Harvard professor Vijay Iyer has his inspirations, Duke Ellington and Jimi Hendrix, but he also says he's inspired by a music of pure thought. His new album is called Break Stuff, built around the sections of songs he called the breaks, to create, as he writes, a span of time in which to act. This conceptual thinker, jazz performer, came to our studio to tell us in his own words about his process for creating a piece of music not composed, but spontaneously born.
All of our music kind of came together casually, you know, in a way, just by having time and having opportunities to try something out in a way that was beyond intention. Sometimes we would just take a fragment of another piece and just loop it until something happened. So that tends to be how we operate, is kind of, it's almost like DJing with our own material, you know, taking a little fragment of something and letting it organically develop. That's how a lot of things happen, actually. A lot of unofficial things, even things that we call genre, they're not planned out. It's more that they emerge from collective action. So that to me is a welcoming idea for how to make music. It's not about the composer. Individual virtuosity. It's about what we can do together, what we can build together. Often I just put in just enough to get things going, and then the rest is up to all of us collectively. It's not one man's show. It's really about all of us and also everybody else in the room. Not just us, but us in conversation with listeners. How do you sculpt an experience for people? And what are the building blocks of that experience? You know, so they're not really thinking, what is EDM or something like that? They're really thinking about connecting with people on the dance floor. The creators of that music, I mean, Robert Hood, Carl Craig, and many of the others, Derek May. The tools that they're working with are mostly synthetic, you know, working with synthesizers and drum machines and that kind of stuff. Well, Robert Hood was quoted as saying, I want to squeeze blood from a drum machine, you know, which is to say that he wants it to feel like there's a body there, there's somebody behind it, you know, or there's somebody in it, maybe is a better way to put it. So it's meant to evoke human presence and human action and flesh. So it's sort of right at that frontier between what we think a person is and isn't. And that's kind of where music starts for me, is right at that frontier. So I like to think about how we might put ourselves in that place. We move when we play to a certain extent. I mean, most of it's kind of just involuntary side effects of trying to make this music work. Dancing to me is a way of listening, right? It's a way of engaging physically with what's happening, with what you hear. That can happen in a lot of ways. I mean, you'll certainly see people tapping their feet or bobbing their heads or, you know, shaking some extremity. You know, when people are seated and in rows of seats, then maybe they have their sort of different possibilities or different affordances available to them. And also, it's even the way you can hear people breathing in a space when we're playing, especially in these clubs where we play that are really kind of intimate, where you are, the audience is right up on top of you, basically. You can hear people breathing, and you start to hear people breathe together.
Pianist, composer, writer, and Harvard professor Vijay Iyer on his new album, Break Stuff, is out now. Some Africans are sick of being talked to. That was the solid impression we got when we gathered a group of African authors who were part of the Pen World Voices Festival last month in New York City. Adewale Adaji, a Nigerian-born lawyer and playwright. Elaine Mubanku is a French citizen born in the Republic of Congo and a finalist for this year's Man Booker Prize. And Kenyan writer Yvonne Adhiambo Uwar, who is the author of the novel Dust. All three of them say they are sick of hearing about how Africa needs to be fixed, that it needs to meet so-called Millennium Development Goals. All three are proud of their fluency in Western languages and thought. But Yvonne said she would be prouder if she was freer to question some of those Western values like democracy, rather than being forced to smilingly accept them, along with billions in financial aid.
Quite frankly, I think the first question is, what is democracy? Sure, the models that have been perpetuated and propagated all over the world, I think people are a bit nervous about calling the emperor naked. I believe your own country went to Iraq to export democracy, and I'm looking at the abyss right there right now. And terrifying, some conversations that need to be had that are not happening. Coming from Nairobi, where it's quite fascinating to see the whole world land and everybody trying to acquire a little stake in a different corner of the country, images that you don't get to see on CNN or BBC, the arrival of the world on African continent, seeking to secure space, land grab, you know, secure land and all those sorts of things. We are very popular these days. It obviously means that there's something amazing happening, and there's something that the world desperately wants, actually desperately craves. 60% of the world's arable land, as you know, is on the African continent. But the responsibility, and quite frankly, my whole thing is, as an African people, we need to decide what it is that we actually do want for ourselves with our assets.
Well, let's talk about the mechanism for Kenyans answering that question you just posed. Mm-hmm. How do Kenyans figure out what it is they want as a government, as a political model? Certainly the Western models and, you know, American models of democracy are utterly discredited in this century so far.
The dream. I think you'd be speaking to a deep dream, one of those dreams that dare not speak out. We'd have to have the courage to stop a while and ask ourselves, you know, eye to eye, and literally look into each other's eyes and say, but what do we want? Who are we? And what does our future, what future do we dare to dream for ourselves? There's such a rush to do so much and everything. And that has been the situation since, you know, kind of the post-independence narrative. We're always rushing to do this and rushing to do that and picking up this ideology and trying that method and having a coup d'etat, that kind of thing. But there's never been a moment of just stopping and asking, who are we? What do we want? Or what does our future look like, smell like, taste like with what we have?
Well, without being patronizing, can the three of you have a conversation like that, given the very different perspectives that you have on the continent, Nigerian, Kenyan, and from Congo? Is there a way that three writers could do exactly what you just suggested right there, Yvonne?
We could, actually. Maybe that's a challenge. We could, but we don't do it.
Well, go for it. Adewale, what do you want? What do you want to say? What do you want in terms of a political future?
Well, I'm very much like Yvonne, that people should live for their dreams, not their nightmares. And I don't want to be defined by what I'm against. I want to be defined by what I'm for. And essentially, when I think about the African continent, what I want is a definition of African excellence. I don't want to be defined by what other people like the MDGs wants to set up. I want people to be able to have the debate, the discussion, to disagree, agree to disagree wherever possible, and explore the dreams. The one thing that this generation of Africans have to give their children is the space and the ability to think and to recognize that God never made a counterfeit, that there is something original about the African like it is about any other group of people, and we should dare to start to think about what kind of world we want to create. There's so many things we can talk about in that context. The challenge of really learning from each other, the challenge of really defining the processes that work for us. One of the most definitive challenges of the African continent is how to collaborate effectively, how to organize. Organization is culturally determined. I mean, you don't have a French company operating like an American company, whereas African companies are getting MBAs in thousands, bringing them in and trying to impose some kind of linear, socially engineered structure on a very complex, adaptive situation. We never industrialized, so we don't have that social engineering thinking. And what it leads to is that we exclude the majority of our people in the design of the future. Usually we end up talking about poverty, but poverty of what? Poverty of material does not mean poverty of ideas. Poverty of material does not mean poverty of thought. It doesn't mean poverty of relationship. In my ethnic origin, the Yoruba people, we have about 30 words for wealth, and only one talks about money. You know, so actually framing life in such a way that money becomes a dominant thing, that we're constantly doing instant gratification, that we are actually not prepared for our own, we borrow content that does not fit our context. And until we start to really be eclectic in what we bring in into the context of our dreams and our desires, we would always have the challenge of being a brand new second hand.
Alain, what would you add to this conversation?
I think that we need to get to know one another. For instance, when I meet a Senegalese, we cannot speak another language than the French. I need to learn Wolof. I need to learn Yoruba. I need to learn Kikuyu. I think that Africans ignore themselves because we have a lot of knowledges which came from the Western civilization, but so we don't pay attention to our own cultures, who are very diverse. I don't like this kind of conversation in which, we came from Francophone world and Anglophone world. It's essential because we are like breaking the wall. And the next step is like to make a kind of inventory of our cultures in order to find what we can put together, which gonna build maybe the next Africa, that Africa which gonna take care also of the world as it is changing right now.
Well, there'll be some Americans listening to this conversation, and I'm sure they'll be fascinated, but they might say to themselves, well, gosh, here all these well-meaning folks in the West have come up with these Millennium Development Goals and created all of these laudable missions for what's going on in Africa and for making things better for people. And here are these three writers saying, we don't want much to do with it all. How would you respond to that?
Let's go back to the basics. It comes back to the fundamental thing. What does it mean to be human? And I don't mean that even in a philosophical sense. I don't know. The well-meaning, and as you know, the road to hell is paved with good intentions. You have to live in the continent to experience the inundation of all these parachuting, well-meaning types with the mission plan and a messianic vision for you, who have not only spoken your entire world and vision, but have ensured that you have absolutely no space and place to speak, because actually, the presumption is that you poor pathetic thing, you have absolutely no means of even understanding who you are in this place in life. And don't worry, we've taken care of it all. It's, I don't know, it's beyond hubristic. And I think my generation has, I think, reached a point of beyond irritation. There's a kind of like, just stop it. Really, just stop it. And let's now start again and let's try to be human. I'm not shutting down doors. What I'm saying is that as a human being, and we are all in this human adventure together, everybody has their dreams. Everybody has a particular vision. Everybody has a longing. The questions that exercise somebody in Texas also exercises a person in my village in Kano. What does it mean to be alive? What does it mean to be human? What's the meaning of my life? And the meaning of my life are not these vague, wafty things called Millennium Development Goals. Actually, MDG fits under the category of fiction, as far as I'm concerned. Or the idiotic idea of eradicating extreme hunger, or, you know, the reduction of the human being into sound bites, commoditized sound bites that look good on business plans or annual reports that absolutely nobody reads. I've reached a point of thinking, let's kind of, come on guys, let's get real. The world's in trouble. There are a lot of solutions everywhere. Let's talk human to human. There are things we need to do, and we need to do them very quickly. And let's stop the wafting and the waffling.
Just stop it.
Just stop
sounds
it,
like,
really.
Sounds like yes, a great yes. book title. I'd love to see that on a UN document. Just stop it.
Oh, dare we hope.
Yeah. Adewale, what do you think?
Well, I start from Baltimore. I start from Ferguson. And I start from the streets of New York. And I see how Africa gets treated here. Because make no mistake about it, we can call black or white. That's not the real essence about African, visibly African. So it's that. Firstly, what does Africa mean to people? When people engage Africa, what do they do with Africa in their own front garden, in their own street? And the second thing is, I have a lot of people with what I'll call the European savior complex. Just as Yvonne was saying, okay, they're going to come and fix a problem. Well, if you really want to fix a problem, first you have to have a good understanding of what you see as a problem. I certainly think that we in the African continent need to be a bit more assertive mm-hmm. about our dreams. I don't want to blame anybody. I don't want to, you know, I'm big, bad, and ugly enough to own my own problems and make it work. I have spent the past few months working on peace building in the Niger Delta. I find it really fascinating that people develop a sense of entitlement without a sense of involvement. And that is a state of orientation that comes from somebody coming in and telling you they will fix your problem and they own your problem. So it's not helpful. It can be destructive, but we have to start from the premise that Africans have to love themselves. We have to start from that premise. We have to negotiate this world on the basis of self-love. Mm-hmm. But once you start going to school, you start to learn an African inferiority complex, because our education system is actually a system of indoctrination into European supremacy. So that we have to take control and start to educate our people in ways that empowers them and makes them equal participants in shaping this world, this very small space we all have together, so that you can learn from us and we can learn from you and we can interact. There are many things that are going on, and it would be exciting if, in talking about what happens on the streets of New York, somebody thought, okay, the Africans have an understanding that can help us here. There's so many incredible things happening on the continent that you can learn from us, but it can never be a one-way conversation, and it was entirely disrespectful to make it such. Mm.
Alain?
Yes, I think also we have to, sometimes I say to myself that I'm not punchy. I need that to take my life and shake it in order to find a solution. And I don't want to be a kind of African who is like crying because he's suffering, he's doing that and that. I need to find my own solution. I don't want to be defined by the other. I don't want to be like this kind of African who is waiting for the help of the other people. Africa is now. Africa is not only yesterday, because being in the mood of saying that, oh, I'm like regretting my empire, I was a king, No, you need to be a king right now in the present, because this present gonna be tomorrow your past, and tomorrow gonna be your present. So nowadays, African from the world, you have to understand that your destiny is in your own mind and in your own hands.
Well, Adewale, Yvonne, and Elaine, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you very much.
Adewale Ajade is a Nigerian-born lawyer and playwright. Yvonne Adhiambo Uwar is a Kenyan writer and author of the novel Dust. And Alain Mabankou is a French citizen born in the Republic of the Congo. He is finalist for the 2015 Man Booker Prize. If you want to catch up on that conversation or listen back to anything on the program, check us out at thetakeaway.org. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
Support for The Takeaway comes from the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia, and the Rockefeller Foundation, whose transportation initiative is promoting equitable and sustainable developments in communities across the country.